Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Hey guys, Steve here. You are listening to one of our original 26 episodes. If you've listened to any of our new episodes, you're going to notice that we're sounding a little different in these ones.
Yeah, there's a reason for that.
There is.
They've been remastered.
They have been remastered.
Because they had a really annoying hum.
Yeah, I mean, a huge thanks to listener James for doing almost all of the legwork on this thing.
Yeah.
You'll also notice if you had listened to what we're calling the Lost 26 episodes before, and you're re-listening now, the music and sound effects are gone.
Yes, yeah. We've gone back to straight audio. So be warned, we sound a little different today than we do in what you're about to listen to.
Yeah.
Enjoy.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Thinking Sideways.
I don't understand.
You never know.
Insufficient data to formulate a reply.
What?
Stories of things we simply don't know the answer to.
Well, hi there. Welcome to another episode of Thinking Sideways. I'm Joe, joined by
Steve
and
Devin.
Hey, so here we are again for another hard hitting. Okay. This is a little bit of an unsolved mystery. There's today we're going to talk about the Surcouf. The Surcouf, for those of you who don't know about it, was a French submarine that disappeared supposedly in the Caribbean, although some people argue differently. But the Surcouf was a submarine that was built in France in the late 20s, early 30s. It was built in the late 20s. It was launched in 1929 and commissioned in 1934 into the French Navy. It was the largest sub ever built at that time. It's about 360 feet. It's about the same length as a Los Angeles class nuclear sub today.
Can you give us a reference that isn't a submarine?
Oh, yeah. Let's see. Well, let me think. It's longer than a football field.
Okay.
Yeah.
So big.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
That's actually very helpful.
It's friggin' big.
Friggin' big. I mean, yeah. Obviously, we're building much bigger subs these days. Mm-hmm. The biggest sub ever built was built by the Russians. It's actually the Soviets, the Typhoon. It was the sub that was in the Hunt for Red October.
Oh, yeah.
560 feet long.
Wow.
That's gigantic.
Yeah, it's enormous. And yeah, so that's the biggest one ever.
Not the one that jumped. That's not the Hunt for Red October one that jumped.
Yeah, that was not. Yeah, that was
jumped.
Not, yeah, that was.
Yeah, you know, in the Hunt for Red October, they come up for air and it's like they jump.
Oh,
and
yeah,
you
yeah.
know
reaches.
Where that sub is.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
I
that was. Yeah, that was a Los Angeles class sub.
Okay.
A lot smaller. So, but at that time, it was a big honking sub and it had to be big because it had to do so much. I mean, it wasn't just doing what ordinary subs do, which is go around and torpedo ships. It also had a big turret on the top of it in front of the conning tower that had 2 8-inch guns in it. And so it was like basically kind of like a battleship. In a
I was going to say 8-inch guns. Those were destroyers at the time had guns that were almost that size.
Yeah.
Didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah. And so.
So it's like a ship that is also a submarine or a submarine that like can glide across the
Yeah, it's
surface?
Like, well, back in those days, really, up until the invention of the snorkel in the 40s, most submarines were really designed and built to run on the surface most of the time and just submerge when controversy occurs, like, say, you know, enemy aircraft shows up and they want to, like, torpedo you and kill you. And so that's a good time to submerge, maybe.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
But back in those days, they spent most of their time on the surface. So anyway, besides having these big honking guns and a turret in front, they also had a hangar aft of the conning tower that contained a float plane.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it was a skinny little hangar, so they had to pull the wings and stuff off of this thing to get it stowed away. I can't imagine what a nuisance that would be. You know, imagine it's like, okay, guys, get up on deck and pull that thing out and put it together.
And take it back apart.
Didn't they say, I don't remember how long it took, but they were talking about in the research how long it took for it to dive and how it made it just like obscenely impractical for like, being able to make it get away from anything.
Yeah, you want to be able to dive quickly, and it took like over 2 minutes to dive.
Yeah.
Get to 40 feet.
Yeah.
To get to just 40
just
feet.
Just a tiny little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
And yeah, I was trying to do a little research on that because that is an extended dive period. And I was wondering if perhaps it lacked a negative tank, because typically diesel subs that we build, I don't know if it's the same for all countries or not, but we build ours with negative tanks. And a negative tank is a tank that when you surface, normally when you submerge, you blow the negative tank out. But when you surface, you fill it up with water. And the idea being is it gives you negative buoyancy. When it's time to flood those tanks, it pulls you under quicker.
Got it.
Yeah, yeah. And so once you submerge, then you blow the negative. This thing perhaps lacked a negative tank. I don't know. Mm. Or perhaps it had a really kind of a pathetically small one.
No, they were just busy like trying to pull things in. And
yeah. I remember reading about the size when we're talking about how big it is, and maybe this is why it didn't have an adequate tank, is it had a area to hold 40 prisoners.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that's...
It had a brig?
Yes.
Yeah, it had a brig.
Its own brig to hold 40 prisoners, which is huge on a submarine.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they were stacked in there like cordwood.
Oh, sure. That's a lot of space.
That is a lot of space on a submarine, yeah. I'm sure they probably made good use of it for storing food and stuff like that. food and wine. So, these were French sailors after all, so they had to have a wine cellar.
Yeah, wine and cheese.
Yeah.
Why did it have the airplane again? Because I remember there was some specific reason that there was a plane involved, because that's not what you'd normally have in a sub.
Actually, back in those days, a lot of subs did carry float planes. It wasn't that unusual.
But wouldn't they just use, radar?
Yeah, they didn't have radar back in those days.
And sonar
was not that well developed either. So, in order to find targets, like say ships and stuff like that, they would launch their plane. The plane would go buzz around and find something, and then come back and tell them, or radio back.
I guess it seems like just such a backwards way to be doing all this stuff, right? It's in that in-between period where they're like, okay, we have to be able to do these things, but we don't have the technology.
Uh-huh.
So I know, we'll just strap some guns on it, strap a plane on it.
I know.
We'll just see where it goes. It just seems so kind of just a bad idea. Bad design.
Yeah, I would imagine that in reality, the plane, for example, would probably not be pulled out of the hangar very often.
Sure.
Can you imagine what a huge nuisance it would be? And you're very vulnerable. I mean, if enemy aircraft do show up while you're, say, dismantling the plane, well, you're just going to have to leave the plane and die.
They were going to make, I think this was the first of seven of these that they were planning to make. Is that correct?
Yeah, the plan was to build a series of them, but this was the first one. And they built this thing because the Washington Naval Treaty placed limits on naval construction. But submarines were omitted from that. So they built this big honking thing, which is basically, they called it a submerged cruiser or something.
Oh, okay.
Or no, excuse me. They called it an underwater cruiser. But basically, yeah, it was a loophole. They were exploiting a loophole. So, well, if we can build this thing that's kind of like a frigate or a battleship or something like that, but it's technically a submarine.
That's totally what it is, right? It's a battleship. It can hardly submerge. It's just like on a technicality, it has to be able to submerge.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and the flaw, when I was doing the reading on this, is the flaw is, okay, well, it's gigantic, which is awesome. We've got this giant sub. It's the biggest one ever made. Mm-hmm. And it's got these massive guns, but because they were on a sub, which doesn't sit that high out of the water, these guns were supposed to be able to shoot, I believe it's 15 miles is how that's an 8-inch gun could shoot.
But max range on these guns was 24 miles, but unfortunately they were not able to see 24 miles.
Right, so they could only shoot, I think it was 8 or 10 or something like
that? Yeah, it depends. Yeah, they had a station where they could sight from the top of the conning tower, and that gave them a range of, I believe, 8 miles, and then if they use the periscopes, they could get a little higher up and they could see further away. That gave them a range of about 10 miles.
I like that they had to use the periscopes.
I know.
And then, above water.
But in theory, if they wanted to go to max range, they could launch the float plane. And then the float plane could actually guide them in.
It's an awkward way to solve the problem.
Yeah.
We don't have this, so we'll do that. And we don't have that, so let's just try this. It just seemed cobbled together.
Yeah.
And it's like, and this is possibly, apparently it was, it looks to me, I mean, if you look at the thing, if you look at pictures of it, it looks really top heavy
for
a submarine. And there was talk about it behaving very badly in rough seas, rolling really badly. And that could be one clue to the mystery of the whole thing as to what happened to it. It's like, and we'll get into the theories about what happened to it. But I'm thinking that it's quite possible that if they just tried to submerge in rough seas. I was like, you noticed earlier I had my old submarine manual out.
Yeah. Flipping through that.
Yeah, I wanted to confirm something that I remembered from reading it long, long ago. But apparently, submersion of a submarine, center of gravity and the center of buoyancy cross one another. So essentially, when you're on the surface, your center of gravity is above the center of buoyancy. And then as you submerge, the center of buoyancy moves up. If you can imagine a line moving vertically through the submarine.
Okay.
And eventually it winds up, center of buoyancy winds up above the center of gravity. But at that point where the two points meet, the submarine becomes very unstable.
Because
it's just like a roly-poly, right?
It's not like a surface ship where, you know, if you list to one side, it sets up a riding arm and tends to push you back.
Right.
It's not like that. And so that's even a possibility that possibly, and I'm getting ahead of myself because, you know, but what the hell.
It's all in the size and the mm-hmm. build of this thing, so it makes sense.
Yeah. So I could see the possibility where it's just bad luck. You know, they're submerging in rough seas and they hit that point of instability
and then they get hit by a big wave.
And I don't know if you guys looked at any pictures or diagrams of the submarine.
I looked at some, yeah.
Yeah. The 8-inch guns are fed by this vertical magazine and the ammunition is stored at the lowest deck of the submarine. And so I'm sure that formed part of the ballast of it, putting all that, because you know that 8-inch ammo's got to weigh a ton.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Those are big, big shells.
Yeah. And so that's kind of something I was curious about. It's like, you know, they obviously weren't able to replenish. They were actually out doing stuff, shooting at things and stuff like that, using up their ammo. And I don't think they had a supply line back to France, which was occupied by the Germans by this time. So what happened down there? Did they think to put counterbalancing weights down there, or did they have trim tanks that could flood?
So it might not have had the weight that they were expecting to counterbalance. Got it. Okay. Yeah. That makes total sense.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself though. Okay. So we talked about the issues that she had. She rolled badly in rough seas and took a long time to dive. So back to the history of the ship a little bit. So she served in the French Navy, but the Germans invaded France in May 1940, the Surcouf. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. All of our French listeners, write in or call. Yeah. She was in Brest being refitted, and I don't know where Brest is, but I assume it's on the coast of France. So at that point, she left and went to England and stayed there being refitted in Plymouth, England. And then in July, the Brits launched an operation called Operation Catapult. And I'm not going to go into all the specifics of Catapult. It had to do with a lot of French ships being either coming over to our side or being scuttled. But in the phase of it that affected the Surcouf is that all French ships that were in port in Britain and also in Canada were boarded by armed Marines. And basically the crews were taken off them and most of them were repatriated to France. And then the idea was that these ships and submarines, whatever, were going to be turned over to the Free French Navy under the Free French guys. Remember Charles de Gaulle and all that stuff?
And I'm guessing the idea, however misguided here, was that if there's any French who are on the ship who have been turned by the Germans for mm-hmm. whatever reason, mm-hmm. that you get them off so that the ship doesn't become a threat to you while you're quote unquote using it in your service.
Yeah.
Would that be a correct assumption?
Yeah. And so, yeah, the French, after the Germans took over, the Vichy government formed and they were basically kind of, what's the word I'm thinking of?
A
puppet government of the Germans. And so, you know, the question was, these sailors, where did their loyalties lie? And so they just decided to, like, take them all off ships and, you know, send them back to France. And then they turned them over to the Free French Navy.
I love that. That's, like, one of my favorite stories in history, right? We couldn't trust some of you, so we're going to condemn all of you and just take all your stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Bye.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Good idea.
I have a fun time. Yeah, and actually, And actually, this is kind of sad, but almost the entire crew of the Surcouf was sent back to France on a hospital ship, which was unfortunately torpedoed and sunk by the Germans.
Oh, really? I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. And so that caused a little bit of bitterness between the
way
France.
Way to go.
And, yeah, I know. And the other thing that caused a little bitterness is that actually the Surcouf saw during Operation Catapult, actually saw a little bit of gunplay on the sub, and three Brits and one French sailor were killed during the boarding of this, which again caused a little bit of bitterness. In August 1940, the Brits completed the refit of the ship and then turned her over to the Free French Navy for a convoy patrol. You know, as you know, there was a lot of convoying going on between America and Britain, and also America and Russia. And so,
between the allies, essentially.
Yeah, essentially. So convoy escorts were kind of necessary. There was only one officer who had not been sent back to France, well, to be torpedoed and killed by the Germans. And that was, Commander Georges Louis Blaison, I think. I don't know.
That sounds right. Yeah.
So he became the new commanding officer, and then a bunch of French sailors for the Free French Navy were put on board her, and she was assigned to convoy patrol. But at the same time, there was still a bit of an atmosphere of distrust between the Brits and the French.
So hang on. Before we go any farther, I've already see a giant issue here, which is she had been running for a year or so with a crew that had learned and knew about the ship.
Uh-huh.
And then they're all jettisoned off of this ship and an entirely new crew is put on and she's put back out to sea.
Yeah, I know. That's
with a bunch of guys who don't know how exactly to do everything.
Especially since she's like so problem ridden, right? I mean, she is prone to toppling. She's got like all these little problems.
Submarines are complex machines too, you know, I'm assuming, you know, that at least a strong percentage of these people had served on submarines before and had some clue what they were doing. You got to hope.
But this is a one of a kind sub. Mm-hmm. She was the only one of her design that was ever built, which means that every ship has its own idiosyncrasies. So you got to know how to deal with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you got guys who, you got to do this, you got to do that, but suddenly they're all gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't know what to do. So you don't know if you're doing something right or wrong, which can make, you know, for a catastrophic situation.
Even in like the most perfect submarine.
Right? Uh-huh. Yeah. And this one had another problem too, which was that it was in Britain. And obviously if they needed spare parts, well, you know, I'm sorry, France, they're back in France, which is occupied by the Germans.
Mm. Right.
So, you know, they're not going to obviously set up a whole manufacturing infrastructure to make parts for this thing.
For just one sub.
Yeah. They're not going to do that.
So we're saying it's even more cobbled together at this point, right? Mm-hmm. All the repairs that are being done, all the
bailing wire and duct tape.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that there's a lot of pieces and parts that could be made from scratch by a qualified machinist and stuff like that, but it would be time consuming.
Yeah. This is the war. Why?
Yeah. So in a sense, it's kind of like a mystery why they even press this thing into service.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like an accident waiting to happen. So, but anyway, there was still a little bit of tension there. They had a new commanding officer and a new crew. There were accusations made that people on the sub were spying for Vichy France. The Brits apparently also claimed that the Surcouf was attacking British ships, because when you think about it, when you're in a convoy in the North Atlantic, then, you know, and the convoys are kind of spread out. And so it would actually not be that tough if you're like one of the escorts to just go ahead and sink one of these merchant ships.
You could
do that. It wouldn't be that tough. You could just sink a merchant ship, you know, and it's like, hey, what happened to him? I don't know. The Germans must have got him. Well,
yeah, but I got everybody on board would have to be on board with that.
Yeah, so the Brits actually as part of this, they stationed a British officer and two sailors on board, supposedly to be liaisons, but more likely just to keep an eye on them and make sure that nothing like this happened. So anyways, the Surcouf went to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and basically escorted transatlantic convoys until 1941, when she was damaged by a German plane, and then went to the U.S. Naval Shipyard at Portsmouth, New Hampshire for a refit, and then went to New London, Connecticut, and then went back to Halifax. Meanwhile, what happened is Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yeah.
Pearl Harbor. So they decided to send the Surcouf to the Pacific Theater. And so she was given orders to sail to Sydney, Australia, via Bermuda and Tahiti and the Panama Canal and all that stuff. So she was going to have a neat little tour. And I could just imagine that, you know, I've read conflicting stuff according to some accounts that I've read about this. At the time that she set out to make this voyage, she only had one functioning engine.
What?
Yeah, I know. I can't believe that. I cannot believe they would have put her to sea for a voyage like that with one functioning engine.
That's a long trip.
So yeah. I am taking that with a grain of salt.
Although I guess it wouldn't be so surprising given that, you know, nobody really could get their hands on the correct parts.
That's a good point. I mean, it's like, yeah, but it seems to me rather dangerous to send a ship to sea with only one functioning engine.
Yeah, although I guess you say, you know, you kind of hedge your bets at that point, right? You say, well, you've only got one functioning engine, but it would take us like 5 years to actually get the parts we need and every fabricator or whatever, you know, or a year, you know, fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's what? 400 fairly disposable dudes on this ship.
It wasn't
and the ship is also like pretty disposable.
Yeah.
So I
yeah,
mean,
what
either
the hell?
We,
yeah.
You know, either they make it and they're helpful or they don't.
Uh-huh.
But we tried.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I really think the proper course of action for this ship would have been to like run it not too far distances for very long until that second engine craps out and then just scrap it and use that steel to build, you know, other stuff on the battleships or something like that.
Or just scrap it.
Yeah, that would have been that too.
Yeah, that just doesn't make any sense. It would be as if I were going to take a road trip in my car, but I've only got first and second gear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's essentially it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to drive 1,000 miles, but it's going to take me weeks because my max speed is, you know, 20 miles an hour. It's foolish.
Yeah,
nobody in good conscience would do that.
Yeah, it is. Frankly, this thing was designed with an inadequate number of engines anyway. And that probably gets back to things like, you know, if you're going to have a big tour and a float plane and a big brig that holds 40 prisoners, well, you gotta make up that space somehow.
Cut somewhere.
Well, but the fleet submarines that the U.S. built in World War II had 4 diesel engines in them.
Hmm.
And, you know, you guys have seen the Blueback.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Blueback.
Here in Portland, yeah.
The Blueback has got 3 diesel engines in it. You know,
The Blueback is
219 feet long.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, it seems to me that 3 is the minimum, you know, really. You know.
For something that size,
yeah,
absolutely 4 is probably needed.
Yeah, I got a chance to take a tour of a Russian Foxtrot submarine, and that's a pretty small dinky sub compared to this thing. And that had 3 diesels on it. I mean, it's like, you know, 3 is a minimum.
Yeah.
So, design constraints are, you know, submarines are, there's a huge design constraint, which is that total volume equals total displacement, which is not the same as for surface ships, where displacement is smaller than the actual volume of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's only so much space on that thing. So I assume to like do things like put a brig in, you had to cut out a diesel engine or two.
Or, you know, the null tank or the
negative tank.
Yeah, the negative tank.
I like the null tank.
The null tank. Yeah, I like the null tank. Who knows? Maybe there is a null tank.
That's where it went.
Yeah. If you look at the tanking diagram of a submarine, you'd be amazed at how many tanks there are on a typical submarine.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
So where were we? Oh, yeah. So anyway, so they decide to send Surcouf to the Pacific Theater. So she left and went to Bermuda, where she resupplied, and then headed south from there to go through the Panama Canal. Mm-hmm. I guess southwest, technically.
Like you do.
Yeah, that would make sense. Mm-hmm. And headed southwest. The plan was to go through the Panama Canal, stop off at Tahiti for a little resupply, and then on to Sydney. So she never made it to the Panama Canal. She disappeared somewhere between Bermuda and the Panama Canal.
Huh.
Yeah, yeah. And so the question is, what happened to her?
Where'd she go?
Here's the unsolved mystery part of things. Yeah.
Oh, we've got to it.
Yeah, finally.
Finally.
Yeah, I know.
Why would they send a ship like this?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a valid question on its own, but.
Yeah. So, again, there were questions about her loyalty. And according to the U.S. Navy, she was done in by an accident.
An accident.
Okay,
yes. So this is my own fault. But when I read this theory, I could never quite understand exactly how this would have gone down.
I don't understand what you didn't understand about it.
Well, it just seems that if this is such a massive ship, I mean, before we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the theory, or give us the details on this particular one?
Well, what the U.S. Navy said is that there's an American freighter named the Thompson Likes was steaming in that area, the same area that the thing that our sub was in, and reported hitting and running down a partially submerged object. And her lookouts supposedly heard people in the water, but they went on without stopping because they were assuming it was a U-boat, a German mm-hmm. U-boat. Although apparently they said they had heard people yelling out in English. So, there were only three people on the boat who spoke English. So, I mean, I mean, some of the French did, but you'd think they would be like yelling in French, but it's hard to say. It was supposedly a very, very dark night. And they just heard and felt rather than saw. There was, I found a thing on the interwebs, some guy who claimed that his grandfather was on the Thompson Likes. And said that he remembered the incident very clearly, and he said it was the biggest submarine he'd ever seen. Although I'm questioning that because I thought it was a dark, moonless night and nobody could see anything.
Yeah.
So,
I guess my question about that is so you assume it's a German U-boat and whatever. Like, humanitarian problems with that aside.
Yeah,
right?
We're going to ignore that.
Fine.
Yeah.
But you have lights on your ship. You have lights on your ship, on the deck of your ship.
Uh-huh.
And maybe you just, shine one down there.
Uh-huh.
Just hey, what was that? Okay, it was. Let's keep going.
Well.
Or, oh, no, that was something much bigger, and we should probably stop and try and help these people.
Yeah, that's the whole thing.
We just hit a whale.
Uh-huh.
Whatever the possibility, you take one light, one lookout person takes one light, turns the switch on.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But it takes one light to get spotted by the enemy and be shot.
This is true. Although if you believe that you've just run over a U-boat, then you've just run over pretty much all of the enemy that's in the area, probably.
So
100 miles around.
They're drowning. You can just watch them drown for a second.
Yeah. I mean, it could be that if obviously from a humanitarian standpoint, because you could have just run over somebody's yacht or something like that. Uh-huh. It's hard to say, but.
A small cruise ship.
Yeah. I mean, but of course.
Rowboat.
Of course, if you really think that it's a U-boat, well, the U-boat doesn't sink, the U-boat might sink you. So maybe you want to beat feet out of there too. I mean, maybe that's why they did it.
I guess, you check to make sure that it's actually sinking. And if it's not, while they're in panic mode, you shoot your one round into them and then they actually are sinking.
Well, you could do that. Yeah.
I guess it just in my mind, again, I understand I'm not a soldier in the war or anything like that. But you shine a light.
I would think you would. You'd want to know exactly what what you ran over. I would think so. But they didn't. And it's kind of surprising because, and I know it's wartime, but law of the sea and all that, you're supposed to stop and help people. Mm-hmm. And especially then they report that they hear people calling out in English.
Yeah.
You'd think that if they actually heard somebody calling out in English, but they really didn't want to stop, then they would just keep quiet about it.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the thing is what I didn't understand, and this gets back to my initial question, is what I didn't get is if the Surcouf is so large and uh-huh. such a mammoth ship,
mm-hmm. yeah.
I would think that hitting it would uh-huh. cause excessive amounts of damage
mm-hmm. uh-huh.
to a topside boat.
Yeah,
I would think that that would just mangle the holy crap out of the hull to the point that that ship would go down as well, because it's just such a big chunk of metal in the water. I guess it could be a glancing blow, but
yeah.
a glancing blow wouldn't sink the sub.
No, but a glancing blow could tilt it off of its axis.
Could knock it over, right? Yeah.
It could knock it over, and it's open. Everybody's true. Like up there doing stuff or whatever, and it tips over.
Well, they said it was partially submerged. They say they partially submerged object.
I would say that the probably even when it's topside, it's partially submerged, right?
Well, I mean, it's always any boat's partially submerged, always. But it's like, you know, I mean, yeah, they could have been diving, for example, or they could have been surfacing, and then and so this thing just sort of scrapes along the top of it. But the thing is, if it did that sort of glancing blow scraping thing, it's not going to probably damage the sub enough to sink it.
That's true. Yeah.
See, it's, to me, and this is where this gets back to where I had issues with it. Mm-hmm. If you think about the two moving perpendicular to each other and they hit at basically a 90 degree angle, mm-hmm. And it causes enough damage to sink the sub, that to me means it causes enough damage to the ship to potentially sink it as well.
That's fair.
If it's a glancing blow, you know, so they're almost parallel to each other, well, then they bounce off of each other, and that doesn't seem like that would be enough force to sink the sub.
Yeah,
that's what I didn't get about this whole we ran them over theory.
That's fair. Yeah, that's totally
fair. Apparently, well, they did hear scraping along their keel, so that, which again, to me, kind of reinforces the idea that perhaps they were submerging. Mm-hmm. And so if they were like kind of submerging already and they got run over, and then, you know, that would cause a lot of scraping sounds and stuff like that. And there was damage apparently to the Like's bow.
I didn't see that when I did
it. It was obviously it wasn't enough damage to stop them.
No, it didn't. But according to the one account that I was talking about, the guy with the grandfather who was on the ship, he said that they were actually taken on water.
Oh, okay.
After the incident.
Okay, so, well, then that adds validity to the theory for me, because I didn't ever see that before.
I also guess you can take on some water as a ship.
Yeah, you still got you got pumps and stuff like that.
You've got pumps, or, you know, you section off that
you shut a door.
Section and you shut your fire door and everything's fine for, you know, the 20 minutes that it takes you.
Even if it's 2 days, it's a sealed compartment.
Yeah.
You're going to list badly, but.
So it wasn't, they were taking on water, but it wasn't catastrophic.
Okay, so that solves that for me, and I can run with that a little more now. Thank you for clearing that up.
Yeah.
I never followed.
You're welcome.
That. It was
Steve.
Very weird. Thank you, Devin.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So
without you, what would I do?
I don't know.
But you know, the question is, I mean, a submarine has two holes. It's got the pressure hole on the inside, then it's got the outer hole that you actually see. The pressure hole is built very stoutly to withstand tremendous amounts of water pressure. Probably the pressure hole didn't get breached. Probably one or two ballast tanks got breached. Mm-hmm. So even if they weren't sunk, they were kind of screwed because, like, say, for example, if your forward ballast tanks can no longer hold air because they've been breached, then if you try to surface, well, you're going to be sort of ass up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
You can still escape and everything like that. You can still escape the sub and you can still make the surface. But you really can't operate in that kind of condition. So one theory that's out there is that they were actually done in by kind of a 1-2 punch, is that they were hit by the Likes and they were damaged enough that they were kind of dead in the water. And that was on the night of February 18th, by the way. So they're dead in the water.
1941?
I believe that was 1941, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The next day, according to the records of the 6th Heavy Bomber Group, they were operating out of Panama, they claimed to have sank a large submarine north of Columbus. That's actually Cristobal Colon, Panama.
Mm.
They claimed to have sank a large submarine. Two A-17s and one B-18 aircraft dropped bombs on this vessel. And so it was quite possibly the Surcouf. Really a bad luck vessel when you think about it, you know, because if this happened, they get run over, they're dead in the water, they're trying to figure out what to do, and then here comes some planes and just bomb the crap out of them and sink them.
So then, I guess by that theory, their communications are down too?
Yeah, probably.
They must have been?
Yeah, they must have been. I don't know.
Because you don't, I mean, it doesn't happen so often that you bomb your own thing, right?
Your radio antennas and towers are all on the top, so if something runs you over, it could have probably the snap off.
That's fair.
Yeah, it could be that the likes took off their radio stuff, you know, and they were unable to communicate. The thing that I find inexplicable about this is that they found this submarine, they sank it, but generally speaking, in the Navy, they have like these cards that they give you that have like silhouettes of various craft, various ships and submarines.
What to look for, what to hit, what not to hit.
Exactly, exactly. They have all these, you know, these, they have these things that you can look at that'll tell you, hey, okay, this is a U-boat. Hey, this is one of ours. And the Surcouf was,
one of a kind,
but there should have been some sort of a reference to it. Certainly, if they looked at their reference cards and said, "Well, U-boat, there's nothing like it." Maybe the Surcouf being a one of a kind, maybe they just never got around to putting it on the identification cards.
I can totally see it not being put in the. If it's one of a kind, why am I going to spend all this time adding it to all these manuals for these guys? And these guys going, well, the Germans have been doing all this other crazy stuff. This must be one of their new subs that we've been hearing about.
Uh-huh.
I can just see a bunch of 18-year-old guys in an airplane going, I don't know what it is. Oh, well, I'll bet you I know what it is, and just going crazy and dropping a ton of bombs on
it. Yeah, just saying, you know, I don't know. I don't see it as – it doesn't look like a friendly one, so let's go ahead and kill it. And
well, I've never seen anything like that. Have you? Nope. Okay, great.
That's what happens.
And, you know, and then you hail it, right? Or what – I don't know what
– That was – hail it.
You hail it, and there's no response, and you go, all right, great.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't look like ours.
Yeah.
It's not responding to our radio.
Well, let's go ahead and bomb the crap out of it. Yeah. Yeah. There are other theories, too.
Well, wait. I guess the next question of that is the place where the ship reported hitting something close to where the bombers reported bombing something?
Yeah, it is. And so
they're close enough that it could conceivably be the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So the same vicinity.
Yeah, they're close. I did find one guy on the web who claimed that the Surcouf could not have been in that place because if it was only running on one engine, it couldn't have actually gotten that far from Bermuda. But I actually did a calculation and I figured out it probably could have.
That's fair.
Yeah, probably could.
Yeah, math doesn't lie.
Math doesn't lie.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah. So no.
That's for another day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like where they were sunk supposedly is about 2,800 kilometers from Bermuda. They have six days to get there.
Okay, but so we've never found it, right? We've never found the wreckage.
Well, according to it's to be believed they know pretty precisely where it's at. They know the latitude and the longitude of where the wreck is at. It's in almost 10,000 feet of water.
Oh.
And so that probably explains why nobody's ever actually gone down to find it.
I guess that's a problem.
Yeah, it kind of is. It would be actually interesting to – I wish somebody would go down. Like, well, we need to write to Robert Ballard and say, dude.
Didn't Jack Cousteau say back in the 70s he was saying he was going to go look for it and try and find it?
There was some rumor about that, but I don't believe he ever did.
Well, no, he never did, but I came across the callus that said that Cousteau was saying he was going to go look for the Surcouf, and he made all this public hoo-ha about it. And then the stories kind of followed that he got hushed up and basically told, no, don't look for that.
Mm-hmm.
It would be in your better interest just not to look for that sub.
Well, so we need to call up James Cameron.
Yeah. Yeah. Robert Ballard is the guy who took him down to the Titanic. That's the guy we need to call up.
Yeah, but we should just call James Cameron.
We should call him because actually he might think that we're so awesome he wants to put us in a movie.
No.
I know.
Anyway, let's move forward, please.
Yeah. So anyway, there are a lot of conspiracy theories surrounding this. One is that it claims that the Brits didn't trust the Surcouf. They thought that the Surcouf was cooperating with the Vichy French and actually sinking Allied shipping. And so one of these theories is that they deliberately sank it using whatever, you know, aircraft and whatever. They just went out and found it and sank it. Mm-hmm. Another one is that when it was in port in Bermuda, British divers swam out and attached limpet mines to it, which were timed to go off several days after. And
what's a limpet mine?
A limpet mine is a mine that's attached to a ship's hull by magnets.
Oh.
And it's called a limpet because it's got a similar to a limpet, which is a sea snail. That clings to rocks and other hard surfaces.
Oh, okay, okay.
So,
well,
so
that makes sense.
Limpet mine.
So basically what this theory is saying then is that they just stuck a bunch of magnets with explosives on it and set a couple of day timer?
Yeah, yeah, that's one possibility.
Okay.
So it's like being James Bond.
Yes, very James Bond.
Yes, Bond, James Bond, yeah. And of course, there's another theory that she was swallowed by the Bermuda Triangle, which, of course, is possible. It's a lot more plausible to believe that, you know, leaving aside limpet mines, that she just suffered some sort of catastrophic failure, because the submarine has a lot of hole openings, you know, that where you have water that, you know, you use water coming in and out of the submarine.
Yeah, you're venting and pulling in the sea constantly.
Yeah, and it's entirely possible that if connection fails and it's believable with this boat was more than 10 years old, and it had been, by this time, 1941, it had been well over a year before she'd had any spare parts available. It was possible that a sea fitting just failed and started letting large amounts of water in. Another story is that she was caught in Long Island Sound refueling a German U-boat.
This one...
I was going to say that if you're going to refuel a German U-boat on the sly, it seems to me like doing it in Long Island Sound is kind of a bad idea.
Yeah. What is the story or the anecdotal evidence behind this? In other words, I know this theory comes from some stories of something being sunk in the Long Island Sound, but I never could figure out how somebody tied it to being the Surcouf.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, there might very well be a U-boat wreck in the Sound. I mean, U-boats were all over the place.
I guess my big question about that is, like, she's running on one engine.
I know.
She's got, like, no extra room in her entire body, right? Why is she refueling other things?
Well, that is a good point. This boat actually did carry quite a lot of fuel for a submarine,
which she obviously needed for herself.
Yeah, probably. You know? And so there's another story is that she was loaded up with French gold. Mm. Yeah.
Flesh that out for me because I didn't see that one.
So another story, and again, I don't place any value on this at all, is that a lot of gold from the French treasury was actually put in their cargo compartment, you know, that big space that was built to house 40 prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's a nice big space. You could stack a lot of gold bars in there.
Oh, those are great ballast.
Yeah, I know. It's nice and low down there, and that would definitely keep you from tipping over.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, but it's like many of these stories about lost ships, somehow gold winds up getting interjected quite often.
I was going to say, this is just like the Aowrang Medan and Yamashita's gold that we talked about before.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What? How did... what was the phrase we used? Shoehorned in.
Yeah, probably.
Oh, I guess, you know, what about slavery? Hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point.
A 40-person haul?
I mean, there's no reason they might have been running slaves from Africa to the New World.
I know it's a little late for that, but
you never know.
So there was a Jacques Cousteau thing. It is claimed that Jacques Cousteau actually did find it and go aboard and grab the gold, and that's why he shut up about it later. But again, that's not exactly believable. And then there was a diver named Lee Prettyman who reported he claimed to have found it in the 1960s, and there was a newspaper article published about it, but he was actually forced to retract his story later on. So apparently he didn't
find it. Because he couldn't provide any proof, I'm guessing.
Apparently not, yeah. And so most of these theories are really fairly weak. The strongest theory is that the 6th Heavy Bomber Group, the one that I mentioned earlier, operating out of Panama, their records do show them sinking a large submarine on the morning of February 19th.
Hmm.
But they never classified the kind of sub that they sank. They said it was a big sub.
And so it seems to me that, you know, quite possibly they were just done in by the old 1-2 punch. You know, they get hit by a freighter, and then the next morning they're trying to figure out what to do and limping towards shore, and then here come these airplanes, and boom. Poor guys. I feel bad for them. I mean, really.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah.
Dying in a sub would not be a nice way to go.
No, there's worse
Either
ways.
You drown or you suffocate or you starve. I mean, like, there are no good possibilities for dying in a sub.
So it's like, yeah, it would be really
it's a terrible way to go, regardless of what happens.
Yeah, yeah. Or you manage to somehow get to the lifeboat, get overboard, get to the lifeboat, and then you, later on you're eaten by sharks, or you drift until you starve to death.
Yeah,
there's all kinds of bad possibilities here.
Yeah. You're picked up by a U-boat, and
yeah.
I mean, no,
anything
good.
Could happen here.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. So anyway, sad story, and it is quite possible that they were done in by British treachery. The Brits, maybe for whatever reason, did decide to put a mine in their hull, but there's really no evidence for it.
Yeah.
So you personally, Joe, lean towards more of the 1-2 punch approach?
Yeah, or possibly even just the 1-punch approach. I mean, there's no real proof that the Thomas Lykes actually hit the Sir Hoof. There could have been other things that they hit. There's all kinds of stuff, even leaving aside ships and submarines. There's all kinds of stuff floating around in the ocean.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you remember after the tsunami in Japan a few years back? Then, like one day, somebody go on the Oregon coast goes out and looks, and there is this big floating dock that washed up on shore.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, there's stuff like that all over the place in the ocean.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't obviously have containers back, and they don't have containers and container ships back then. But these days, you know, container ships lose containers over the side all the time. There's containers out there floating around. And, you know, even back in those days in World War II, there's all kinds of stuff floating around in the ocean that you can run into.
Yeah.
So it may have been the 1-2 punch, or it may have just been that the Thomas Lykes hit something else entirely, and then these guys showed up on February 19th in the early morning and sank the Sir Hoof.
Personally, based on the history of this vessel, I have a feeling that it's more of the mechanical issues.
Yeah.
She had some kind of failure because all this reading about, you know, we couldn't get parts for her and all this stuff. It just seems to me that something, she basically sprang a leak and went down because things just stopped working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Seems the simplest, again, it's Occam's razor, but it's the simplest answer and to me more plausible.
Submarines, again, they operate in a very hostile environment, and they are very complex machines. There's a lot of points of failure, and they can easily be done in by just a mechanical failure.
I think when I was working on cruise ships, which is not comparable to a submarine really, but a little bit it is, that we had a ship in our fleet that like had to go in for repairs like 4 times or something like that. And there was one time where they like took it out for repairs and like the front sea door just fell off.
The what?
The front sea door. So it was like where they would load all the like cargo or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So it was usually like above water.
Uh-huh.
And then they would drop it down into the water and it just fell off.
Plonk.
Like it was underwater, just fell off one day. Like it happens all the time. You know, somebody doesn't solder something on quite right. You know, you're
bad
out.
Bad welds, loose bolts.
It's been, 20, 30 years since they even had parts that were actually made for them. You know, they've been just cobbling repairs together.
It was 10 years.
10 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
10 years.
10 years. Yeah.
But yeah.
10 years is a long
time
still.
That's a long time when
you're
in service and constantly and guys are working on it. Metric versus standard.
Yeah.
It's easy to get everybody confused.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So I guess I agree with Steve.
Yeah.
I think some kind of mechanical failure or a bombing. I don't think. Yeah.
It could have been the bombing. It could have been.
I'm pretty sure it wasn't aliens, but maybe.
You don't think so?
It might have been.
Really? Yeah. Okay. You think it might? Okay. Well, that's good enough.
I'm willing to allow like a 20% possibility.
Okay. All right.
On this one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so anyway, it's too bad for the Sir Hoof. I think we solved this mystery pretty conclusively, and we think that maybe it was aliens. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. 20% aliens.
20% aliens, 20% bombing from the air, and 60% just mechanical failure.
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds right.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay, the Sir Hoof. Yeah. And so now you're all experts on the Sir Hoof. All right, so if you want to see pictures of the Sir Hoof, I've actually found a cool picture of a cross section of a model of the Sir Hoof. And so you can look at that and get an idea of the complexity of this beast. And also, if you want to see links to other sites, they will be on our website, which is thinkingsidewayspodcast.com. And if you'd like to, if you were actually on the Sir Hoof and you somehow miraculously survived, or if you were on the Thomas Lykes and you want to like weigh in a little bit here and tell us what happened that fateful night, you might want to send us an email, which is thinkingsidewayspodcast@gmail.com. Also, don't forget to check us out on Facebook and iTunes and Stitcher. And if you're downloading an episode through iTunes, please stop, give us a rating, give us a review if you possibly can. We really appreciate it. Let's wrap this up. Another mystery solved here on Thinking Sideways. That's it. Goodbye.
Talk to you guys soon.
It was aliens, I'm pretty sure. Like 90% sure.
No. Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah.
I'll go with that.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.